It is Wednesday, August 26, 2020. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live to tape steps and steps and steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, day three of our pre-recorded shows for the vacation. At this point, my guess is it's been raining the entire time we've been at the beach. Saul has exhausted all of the 43 Lego sets that I got him. Myla and her friend are telling me that they're bored, and I have already started the day drink. However, you will get the opportunity to listen to this great interview with Richard Kreider. He's a writer for The Nation magazine. He wrote a book called Break It Up: Secession, Division, and the Secret History of America's Imperfect Union. Really fascinating look at how we have cobbled together this nation in many respects, and in many respects, it's really being cobbled together. And it's obviously he couldn't anticipate what was going to happen with COVID, but this book looks into the notion of federalism and how it functions in this country. And, you know, we saw some examples particularly at the beginning of this whole pandemic, where there were states that basically formed interstate compacts. And there was really a sense of like, what's going to happen here? And that seems to be past us for the moment. But who knows what's going to happen in the future? I am sort of like out of the prediction game. Like I basically, the only prediction I feel really confident in making, and I'm making this prediction at the end of last week, that's when I'm recording this, is that by now, you know, there's some frayed nerves with me and the kids. That's my prediction. That one I feel pretty confident about. Everything else, not so confident. But right now, there's some frayed nerves. I'm hitting the CBD, my Sunset Lake CBD. I'm hitting that pretty hard right now. It's okay. A little bit of tincture, maybe a gummy, just to, so that I can, you know, maintain my composure. Kids are getting a little antsy. It's a little bit difficult. I'm with my dad. That can always be a challenge, with all due respect. My sisters, sometimes siblings will fight. So that's my only prediction I'll make. But in terms of, you know, where this country will be and what the future of federalism holds, and who knows. But it's a fascinating conversation. It's also, he's got some other ideas about what we need to do in this country and relatively, relative to democracy. You'll enjoy this. Also tomorrow I've got a interesting interview with, Steve Olson. He has written about sort of like a secret history of where, we just basically had some nuclear waste. Yeah, what are you gonna do? And then on Friday, a great interview with Saywood Darby about women in hate groups. So, but right now, take a quick break. When we come back, Richard Kreider on his book, Break It Up, Secession, Division, The Secret History of America's Imperfect Union. Enjoy. We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program contributing writer to The Nation magazine and author of Break It Up, Secession, Division, and the Secret History of America's Imperfect Union, Richard Kreider. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me, Sam.
Okay, so let's start with let's start with some of that secret history. I think people have a pretty good sense of division, and I want to get into sort of the, you know, what the point of secession would be at this stage in our development as a nation, or failure to develop as a nation, as it may be. But give us some of the The times that the country nearly broke up. I mean, I think everybody's aware that the South seceded, and Lincoln didn't want that to happen. And then we had a pretty nasty civil war. But give us a sense of other times when there have been moments where it appeared that it was possible that the country would fracture into smaller countries, I guess.
Sure. Yeah, there's been lots of examples of that, and that's the story of the book. The secret history that I'm telling is both the story of attempts to break it up, and also for the first 150 years of European settlement on this continent, the failure to form a union in the first place. So the beginning of the book is telling the story about why were American colonists so reluctant to form one? Why did they not want to join together at all? And then I think that those hesitations and reservations that they had indicated something about the fragility of the union later on. So right after the Revolutionary War, the victorious patriots kind of looked at each other and said, well, what do we do now? They really had very little in common. They spoke about their own colonies, now states, as their countries, their nations. And they weren't really sure whether they wanted to form a union that was going to last at all. And almost immediately, it broke apart. And that's why the Constitutional Convention was required. But that didn't really solve the problem either. In the 1790s were probably the most partisan decade that we've ever seen, you know, I think on par with the 1850s and probably today. They were just at each other's throats completely. And it seemed on several occasions, like after the 1800 presidential election, where they couldn't, it was, as we might see again this year, a contested election, where there was no clear leader and the House of Representatives couldn't decide on one. And the two sides, the Republicans and Federalists, very nearly came to blows. It was going to be a civil war. Again, during the War of 1812, the New Englanders wanted nothing to do with that war and actually talked very loudly about seceding from the Union if Madison and the Republicans, who were in control at the time, didn't cave to their demands. And that goes on and on, all the way up to the Civil War. You know, one of the interesting stories right now, of course, is California secessionism. But a lot of people don't realize that that's a very, very old idea, the idea of breaking off California and even Oregon, Washington, much of the West Coast, and forming a separate Pacific Republic is an idea that Thomas Jefferson supported, Daniel Webster supported, and had a lot of support on the ground in California and Oregon in the 1840s and 1850s. That's kind of another like aspect of the secret history that we're not really taught in school. And then just finally, I'll say, you know, we usually think that a lot of people think kind of lackadaisically that the Civil War settled this question, you know, settled it at Appomattox. That's really not the case. It was simply a military defeat. You know, I think Confederate apologists and nostalgists, heinous though they are, kind of have a point with that. The South simply lost a military fight. It didn't prove anything about the constitutional right of secession. And I think that you see it pop up in the past 150 years in the strangest places. There have been schemes by Mexican revolutionaries to take back the Southwest. There have been Black nationalists who wanted to take five Southern states as a form of reparations for slavery and establish a separate Black republic. There's a new book out about that, which is really good. And again, today you're seeing disunion and the idea of secession kind of roar back. This concept, this idea that we all thought was dead and buried, but you're seeing it in Texas and in California, in Vermont, in the South, in the Northwest, Alaska, Hawaii, almost everywhere. I think it suggests that there's something going on, something that's never really been settled in the first place.
So this idea that the question of the constitutional right to secede was not settled, they simply lost a military battle, and that question continues on. That raises, well, all right. So the reasons why historically different parts of the country have decided to secede or have contemplated, I guess, secession have been. It appears, according to your book, ranges from material things to also ideological things. Yes, or is it been primarily material?
I think it's primarily material, and that's usually cloaked in ideological, you know, garb. And what's really interesting to me is how that ideological garb can be put on and taken off at a moment's notice. You know, the moment that one side loses or wins an election. You know, throughout the early American history, and I kind of think there's similar examples today, any party that was in power supported a strong central government and insisted on keeping the Union together no matter what. And as soon as they lost power, they were for states' rights and secession and nullification. And we see a similar thing today, especially with executive orders. you know, under Obama, we were all for it, you know, with DACA, with climate change. And then, of course, as soon as we lose power, rightly so, we're criticizing Trump for resorting to the same tactic. And I think you're seeing that in even stronger terms, not just executive orders, but states' rights and even nullification of federal laws. You know, what else is sanctuary cities? But a lighter form of that. And I think that once we take power, hopefully this fall, and Republican states start doing something similar with laws that we pass, I think we're probably not going to like it.
Okay. And so, I mean, much of you say the union has functioned in some respects to function contrary to the Declaration of Independence. Explain that dynamic.
I guess what I mean by that is that the Declaration enshrines a right of revolution, the right to alter or abolish your government whenever it is not serving the ends for which it was established, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And many people throughout American history, including the Confederates, but not only them, you know, my heroes of the book are really the abolitionists who favored disunion as a way to protest and undermine slavery. All of those people have cited the Declaration of Independence against the union that it supposedly, according to Abraham Lincoln, created. So the idea of a perpetual union, as we like to say, seems to be at odds with the revolutionary right to alter or abolish your government when it opposes the ends for which it was established.
And yet, we still have this question in terms of the constitutional right to secede. Right?
Well, I don't really come down in the book one way or the other on that, simply that it has been contested from the very beginning. You know, I show that three states explicitly reserved the right to withdraw their consent to join the union and to ratify the Constitution as a condition of their assent originally. And I really think, and I think a lot of scholars believe, that no state would have signed on without that understanding. So that was the original understanding. The question is, what happened after that? You know, if you ask people like Lincoln, part of that tradition, they say that in time the Union became, you know, an unbreachable nation, something that it was not at the beginning. You know, whereas at the beginning it was a means to an end. For some people, by, you know, 1860, certainly, it was an end unto itself. For others, certainly for the Confederates, but also, as I show, for Northerners before that, and for many people since, it continued to be a means to an end. And people argue that side of the question. You know, there's a time where Frederick Douglass, when he's opposed to the Union for support of slavery, he says that, of course, states have the right to secede. You know, he changed his mind on that 10 years later. But a lot of people have thought that throughout American history, that it's not totally settled, and that the Civil War did nothing really to settle it.
Has there been, I mean, how genuine throughout these years do you think that impetus to secede has been, as opposed to just a threat, like I'm going to take my ball and go home?
Yes, no, that's definitely a rich question. I mean, it's hard to, you know, tease out the hypotheticals of who would and who would not have gone through with it. The question is, can you make a plausible threat? And if you can, you probably are going to get what you want. You know, I found throughout the book that secession threats secede, succeed. Threats to secede tend to succeed. You know, if you can make a plausible threat that you're going to take your ball and go home, the other side kind of needs to give you what you want, unless they're ready to go to war over it or see the Union break apart. And it's Lincoln's decision not to give in 1861 that I think is truly revolutionary and truly, you know, genius and heroic. You know, it had been the tradition to always give in to Southern threats. In 1833, during the nullification crisis, they gave in, they lowered the tariffs. In 1850, you know, the fight over Western territories, the North also gave in. But in 1860, 1861, Lincoln refuses to. And I think that carries a kernel of disunionist logic to say, no, we will not compromise for the sake of the Union. We'd rather go to war. I think that's kind of the spine that we're lacking in many, you know, Democratic leaders today.
In Democratic leaders, in terms of, like, I mean, what do you mean by Democratic leaders and leaders of democracy? The party, right? Is that?
Yeah, I mean, I don't go with, you know, Dinesh D'Souza saying that the modern Democratic Party is the ancestors of the you know, mid 19th century Democratic Party. I think it's quite the opposite. I think of the Democratic Party today as the North, the party of freedom, the party of progress. You know, and I think that we give in to Republican threats all too often. And I think that, that there's a certain analogy there to the 1850s. And it was only when the North, you know, found its own spine and its own, and countered Southern threats with their own disunion threats, especially after like Dred Scott, for instance, truly appalling, you know, Supreme Court decisions. And we're seeing some of those again today. It was only when the North, you know, countered and said, well, we also think that the Union is only worth keeping together if it serves certain ends. That's when you had the crisis. That's when you had things brought to a point. I don't want another civil war. I don't want 750,000 people to die. But I do think that standing up for what you think is important is all there is. You know, and I still think that the country is meant not to stay together for its own sake, but to serve certain ends. And it should stay together only so long as it does so.
Simultaneously, when you look back on this history, you find that in many respects, white supremacy, imperialism have functioned as I don't know, is glue the apt metaphor, or is it
yeah.
Is it more of like a caulk? Like there's a little bit of give in there.
Yeah, no. I think I'd go with glue. I think that's a really good point, and that's another major theme of the book, showing that yes, the country stayed together. That's great. You know, I think a lot of people today say we're going through really difficult times, but we've had difficult times before, and we survived, so we should take heart, and if likely, we will do so again. And I say to that one, no, you know, it largely stuck together through chance, and especially through really odious compromises that enshrined white supremacy and, as you say, imperialism as well, from Indian removal to, you know, wars abroad in like 1898, the Spanish-American War, as the mission of the country. And those were the terms on which the country could stay together, indeed the only terms on which the country could stay together. So if we're hoping, you know, this goes back to what I was just saying, if we're hoping that the country will stay together no matter what in the coming crisis, well, it's probably that you're giving away the game. You're basically saying we will agree to anything. We will agree to forfeit all of the demands for justice that have, you know, been raised so memorably this year. We're willing to give all that up for the sake of peace and compromise. And I just don't think that we should say that from the outset. I think that's kind of the lesson of the Obama era, you know, and that's kind of where the thought that led to this book came from.
Well, yeah. I mean, talk about that. I mean, I mean, there's multiple ways of interpreting the failures, to the extent that those of us see failures during the Obama years. There's multiple ways of perceiving those failures. One being that there was a failure of, I don't know, for lack of a better term, maybe partisanship or understanding of partisanship, that the Republicans had decided, you know, we're entrenched, and therefore the Obama administration needed also to be entrenched. The other perspective is that maybe there wasn't, the Obama administration did not see, presume, maybe there wasn't as great of an ideological difference as maybe it looks like from the outside. And in fact, this compromise was not simply a function of like, let's hold things together, but like, this is sort of where we want to land anyways. And they just got the Republicans that wouldn't take yes for an answer.
Right. Yeah. No, I think that's a really good point. I think a lot of it is, you know, negotiating, starting from a position of weakness or compromise, and then negotiating from there. And then, yeah, the Republicans just would refuse to play ball at all. But I started feeling late in the Obama era, when these executive orders were coming down, like 2014, that there was a serious constitutional obstacle to what we were trying to achieve. And that was largely the Senate. That was the Supreme Court, you know, gerrymandered Congress, which now has been ratified by the Supreme Court. And it just seemed to me like the need to bring along the entire country in order to get anything done, to get health insurance, to do anything on climate, like that was what was blocking our program, what we wanted to get done, you know. And it just seems like the nature of the country was such that it would never arrive. We were never going, you know. I was for Bernie Sanders both times he ran for president, but I'm not terribly surprised he wasn't able to push it over just by the composition of the country. And I just wonder if you compose a different country, you know, maybe we could have some of those things.
All right. Well, I mean, let's look at that. What's the impetus here? Is it on ideological grounds, or is it on, from the perspective of someone, you know, and you and I share, I imagine, an ideology, and, you know, we look at certain things as material, right? Like saving the planet. That's a material benefit. That's not ideological. I don't perceive dealing with climate change as ideological. Medicare for all. That's a material benefit for people. The people who disagree with that, at least a certain segment of them, perceive that as purely ideological. The global climate change is not there. They would just say you just want a different way of organizing things. I mean, so what would be the point, and whose point would it be, I guess, to secede, and then we'll look at more like the mechanics of it.
Yeah. I don't support secession at this moment. I'm simply raising it as a possibility down the road, and I think one that we should be open to. You know, if we're talking about the arrival of fascism in America, then I don't really want to be a part of that. You know, I would prefer that I live in New York. I would prefer that the Northeast, you know, I don't know, take steps, I think, appropriate to that level of crisis. I don't think we're there yet, and I hope we won't be. But you might be able to, I don't think, if you question about ideology, you know, I don't think that the point of secession or of disunion or even a lighter version, which, you know, we can call devolution, while maintaining the form of the United States, the point is not ideological purity in each of those new components. You know, I think that's kind of a hopeless, foolish cause that could probably lead to all kinds of violence and mayhem. The idea is not to not be part of a country with people with whom I disagree. I don't agree with that completely at all. The idea is that perhaps we can get more done closer to home. You know, maybe we don't need to be arguing over every single issue in Washington. And that will require trade-offs. You know, perhaps, I raised this in a piece, you know, perhaps the West Coast and the Northeast can have universal health insurance, but we have to give up on the right to determine reproductive rights policy in Mississippi. Is that a worthy trade-off? I don't know. I don't think so. But I don't know. I think that's kind of where this country is headed, is questions like that, is coming to some kind of new truce, which would require, you know, trade-offs. But I think there are trade-offs with the current system as well. And you mentioned climate change.
So wait a second. I want to stay with that example. So the idea is, you're saying we wouldn't necessarily break up for, there wouldn't necessarily be secession, but there would be a broad understanding that we're going to have different rules in different states. I mean, on some level, that what you're talking about, it seems to me, is sort of like the Federalist Society, right? I mean, they want to do that. That's as far as they will take it in terms of abortion, for instance. I mean, I think there's every reason to believe, particularly if we lose another Supreme Court justice in the next couple of months, but even going forward, that we will probably get to, if not a declared, you know, an explicit situation like this, but certainly one in practice where abortion is legal in some states and illegal in others.
Which would be a travesty.
Right.
You know? But they're also likely to strike down, you know, laws passed by the next Democratic president in Congress regarding all kinds of things, you know, the Green New Deal. You know, health insurance. I mean, it's all up for grabs.
No, but I'm asking relative to your suggestion that, like, maybe we'll got to get into a situation where East and West Coast have a Medicare for all type of thing. But abortion's outlawed in Mississippi, let's say. I mean, what are the mechanisms for that?
Right. So, I mean, the devolution example, you know, what I was going to say about the Federalist Society is one difference that I have with that, you know, traditionally conservative view, is that I have no respect at all for the states. I think the states are arbitrary beings with no real organic purpose to them. I think we should abolish the Senate, you know, for one thing. But if we were to break down the country rather than break it up, I would propose regional formations, you know, about 8 to 12 of them, which would take most of the power from the state and the federal government. I don't believe in states, you know, basically, where I think most, you know, traditional constitutional so-called conservatives do. So what would be the mechanisms of that? You know, there was an interesting piece in New York Magazine a few years ago arguing that the provision in the Constitution that allows states to form compacts with one another, often with congressional authorization required, could be used to essentially redesign the constitutional framework of the country. You could have states form compacts for all kinds of things, for health insurance, climate change policy, you know, certain, and what's interesting to me is that we started to see this in the spring with the coronavirus.
Yes.
Three groups of, I think, 17 governors form agreements with one another to coordinate, PPE, purchases and also economic lockdown policies. And I think that that could be a very interesting and potentially useful and very progressive, way to arrange things in the future. If it seems like the national government, as it seems to me, is totally dysfunctional and the country as it currently is organized, ungovernable.
Okay. So, yeah, I mean, I have to say that, like, you know, there was a moment, maybe it was in, April, where I felt like, oi, this is happening now. We're seeing these PACs form. We do have a regime now in this country where, I mean, if you fly into New York, if you fly into Massachusetts, in fact, if you come from Rhode Island now, you cannot get into Massachusetts unless you quarantine for 2 weeks. Now, they haven't quite set up border patrols yet, you know, to enforce this. Although I think, you know, if you come through with a Rhode Island license plate, you're going to get some side eye, and you're supposed to register if you land in an airplane. So, I mean, there's a quality of this, but you know, the PACs that were formed were done completely out of desperation, right? I mean, it was a suboptimal arrangement. It both showed the possibility of this type of, I guess, fracturing, but it also, in my mind, showed the necessity for a strong federal government. So, like, you know, why would Congress, I guess, I mean, I guess maybe the House in this instance might, because it's controlled by the Democrats. But why would there be an allowance for this when ultimately, you know, you start to head down the road where New York and California are, you know, part of their own, I don't know, province, and they don't have the same compacts with, I don't know, Mississippi and Alabama. Mississippi and Alabama are in some pretty dire straits when it comes to, you know, revenue.
Yeah, well, sure. That's a whole kind of a whole nother question. I don't see this happen. You know, a couple of things. One, yes, there was this moment in April. Perhaps it seems to have passed. But what about this November? You know, if the worst comes to pass with the election, Trump sends his goons into Democratic cities to, you know, guard the polls. There's you know, two presidents, you know, trying to be sworn in on Inauguration Day. I mean, things can get messy very, very quickly. I don't know that they will. But I think that what you saw happen in April with these governors joining together in a moment of desperation, I think climate change, for instance, is sure to bring many more such moments of desperation. And perhaps I agree, it's not a optimal situation. I also would prefer a strong, stable central government. I just think that given, you know, we elected Donald Trump president and we could easily do it again, either this year or some other, you know, Trump iteration in the years to come. It's not a stable country, and its federal government cannot be relied on to, as I say at the beginning, secure our rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. So we might have to come up with, you know, contingency plans, and by we I mean Democrats, progressives, if we're not able to get the country and the government that we want.
If the answer is that type of fracturing, so that, you know, the Northern and Western Alliance, let's call it, you know, New California province can deal with climate change. I mean, on some level, like, we're still not going to be able to do so as efficiently. Like, I mean, if we're talking, you know, material benefit here, it's going to be harder to do Medicare for all. Maybe it wouldn't be if we were just talking about New York and California, because so much revenue comes from there. But, you know, we a state right now, states have maybe not so much under Donald Trump, but certainly under Obama, had the right to do a single payer healthcare system. Right. Vermont was contemplating doing that. But they got scared off by the amount of taxes that it would involve, at least in the context of that state. Because a state, it doesn't have the resources, frankly, that the federal government does, that issues its currency. And presumably, right, we would keep the American dollar, because without the American dollar, I don't care what province you are, you're at an extreme disadvantage in terms of like our ability to print money, essentially.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, there's a lot to chew on. I don't go into the book at all on the question of like, would each of these new regional formations or countries have their own currency? You know, it's a history. It's not like a program for exactly how this would work or answering every question. I kind of hope that other people will take up that task. As for health insurance, you know, you have lots of countries the size of maybe not Vermont, but certainly New York, certainly California, who have universal health insurance, who don't have the resources that either of those states alone, much less together, have. If you were to seriously redraw the relationship between states and the federal government, you know, New York and California, you know, get back much less than they send out to Washington in federal tax revenue.
Right.
So if we were to, you know, defund the American military, for instance, I think we'd probably be able to afford Medicare for all. As for climate change, I think that's the really important point. I think that's the reason to stay together. If we can do something nationally and thus internationally, you know, as in leading the world or whatever, on climate change, I think that is a really good reason to stay together as a country, akin to, you know, ending slavery. That was Lincoln's point. We should stay together because we stand for liberty. We can actually do something really important in the world, which is set slavery on the course of ultimate extinction. So that's why he decided not to compromise and to go to war, you know, as a bet that the country would in time become worthy of saving. And I think that the same is true today with climate change. But if we wake up one morning and it seems like that is never going to happen, and I think we're pretty close to that, then perhaps we should divide and split apart so that the rest of us can do something. You know, you have California right now trying to pass their emission standards and the federal government standing in the way. That's just one, you know, that's the first kind of example of that. But I suspect certainly if Trump is reelected, I suspect we're going to be seeing more of that. And I think that progressives, calculations about whether the union is worth it might begin to shift.
And that may be a good source of leverage. I mean, have we in the course of your reviewing this history, have we ever had an administration that has been so hostile to the idea of the federal government? I mean, that's what it seems like. You know, there are certain things that they like, right? The ability to, oh, we have access to federal prison guards. We have access to federal ICE SWAT teams. We could use those. But I mean, I'm talking in terms of like the other broader functions. Have we, because the response to the coronavirus, there is no scenario where I would have guessed that if we are struck by a pandemic, and maybe there's a failure of imagination on my part, we're struck by a pandemic, the federal government's response is basically going to be like, states, you got this. I mean, that it would be the last thing that I would think would happen. Have we ever had a federal government, an administration that is so hostile to that concept?
I think we have. I think the anti-government, the anti-federalist, you know, to use the original term, ideology in American history is incredibly strong. You know, Jefferson came in and defunded the federal government. He was against, you know, spending. And that was true for like almost most presidents up to Lincoln before the Civil War and for several after. So many have been hostile to the federal government. You know, look at Herbert Hoover. I mean, he didn't want to have to do anything with regard to the Great Depression. I think what we have not really seen, and you see hints of it in Nixon, but nothing real at all until Trump, is a president and an administration so open about that the fact that they only represent and really only govern one part of the country and have absolutely no concern at all for the other part. They don't even give lip service to the idea of representing those who did not vote for them and for him. And that I think we have not seen. And I think that makes Trump the most divisive president in American history, intentionally so. And I, you know, some people have aptly called him the second Confederate president, of course, because of his, you know, overt sympathies for white supremacy. But I think that it also applies with his use of disunion essentially as a governing strategy. And as I say, you see some of that in Nixon, but nothing like what we see now.
Right. I mean, we have seen things like, you know, George Bush bringing down emergency services to Florida right before an election in 2004 because of a hurricane. But Donald Trump is explicitly out there going like, we're not going to bail out Democrat governors, essentially. I mean, not essentially. That's what he said. I think that may be an actual quote, which is really stunning. This is not just it almost becomes not just an electoral tactic, but also like an electoral strategy. Like,
yeah,
I'm the only thing that's standing between between essentially the northern hordes or the, you know, that half of the country controlling the other half of the country.
Yeah, well, you know, the thing about the blue state bailouts in the spring was really interesting because you saw a lot of people on the left kind of reflexively say, hey, wait a minute, you're not bailing us out. We bail you out every single year. You know, I would love to stop doing that. And then, you know, the implication was we could have Medicare for all. And then you have this whole other part of the left saying that's horrible. What kind of spirit, what kind of solidarity, you know, is that? And I think that this is probably going to define the divisions on the left for the next decade or so. And I'd be, you know, I'm obviously curious to see which side wins out. But I think that a lot of us are getting absolutely fed up with not calling the shots in a country that, one, we have the majority in, as your show aptly puts it, and that we fund by far the majority of with economic activity and tax revenues. So hopefully, you know, I hope that the book stirs people on that side of the political divide to start thinking in those kind of empowered terms. You know, we don't need this.
I mean, it really is stunning.
I still think we do, but
It really is stunning when, and I don't think most people have this in the forefront of their consciousness, but something like 40 some odd percent of the country controls 55%, that's all you need, of the U.S. Senate. And that's just absurd, right? I mean, it's just...
Oh, it's less than that, I think. I think it's like you can stop a bill with the filibuster. You can stop a bill with, I'm pretty sure, 8% of the population.
Well, and the filibuster, I think, is going to go away. But nevertheless, the majority, the Republicans have the majority in the Senate with a significant minority of the population in the country being represented by those senators, because the Senate in and of itself is just an incredibly undemocratic institution. And I don't know that people have that in the forefront, that there's a whole host of things that, you know, at the very least ostensibly should be within our reach to get in terms of material benefits, except for the fact that a minority of the country has said, we're not going to allow that to happen.
That's precisely right. That's precisely right. And I really think that abolishing the Senate or otherwise taking away its veto is really the only thing that we can do to save the country, because I think that we should be putting the demand forward of do that, abolish the Senate. I also think there's other things, the Electoral College, radically expand the size of the House of Representatives. But the Senate, as you say, is the real choke point. Abolish the Senate or we walk. You know, I think California is going to start saying that. And I think that I hope we choose to take the path of constitutional reform. But I think that this is something that the left needs to start talking about. I don't think we talk about the Constitution enough.
Right. And having this in our forefront provides a certain amount of leverage and perhaps maybe something that would stiffen the spine of those people who are at least presumably advocating on our behalf. Richard Kreitner, the book is Break It Up: Secession, Division, and the Secret History of America's Imperfect Union. Thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Really enjoyed it.